The podcast network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves. And Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's a way, such a better way, today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
All right, this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 151. And with me tonight, we have the honor of Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner Dale Klein. And in addition to Mr. Klein, we have Dan Yerman, who blogs at Idaho Samizdat, John Wheeler from This Week in Nuclear, Margaret Harding, and Meredith Angwin from Yes Vermont Yankee. Welcome, you all, and please introduce yourself so that people have a feel for what your voice sounds like.
Good evening. This is John Wheeler. Great to be here, Rod. Thanks for setting this up. And it's a pleasure, Mr. Klein, to also speak with you.
Thanks, John.
This is Meredith Angwin. I'd like to thank you, Rod, for inviting me to speak. And I'm very pleased to be speaking to Dale Klein. It was very, very impressive to be able to speak to him.
And this is Margaret Harding, and I'm delighted to be on this call once again with Rod and the gang, and pleased to be speaking with Mr. Klein.
And this is Dan Yerman from Idaho Samizdat. Hello to everybody once again. Thank you.
And I have to give Dan credit because he's the guy who actually got the contact and suggested that we set up this discussion. Mr. Klein, you are currently serving as a commissioner, but I believe you were the chairman of the commission for a while. Is that correct?
That's true, Rod. I was sworn in July 1 of 06 and served until May of 09 as chairman.
Very good. And I presume that you're getting ready to head back to Texas. Is that your plan for the future?
That's true. I will return to the University of Texas at Austin, where I have a tenured faculty position, but I will be doing some administrative work in the Office of the Vice President of Research and the Research Institute.
I'm sorry that something broke up a little bit. Where will you be working at the university?
I'll be working in the Vice President for Research's office and with an Energy Institute.
Well, Rod, if it's all right with you, I'll kick off the questions for Dale Klein. Two questions probably at the forefront of many listeners. First, what would you see as your legacy at the NRC, the high points of your tenure? And second, looking into the future, what do you see as the challenges that the three new NRC commissioners who are likely to be sworn in shortly will be facing at the NRC?
Well, I think the high point is probably having been able to recruit some very talented people to the agency during an expansion time. And so we have obviously, with the new license applications and other activities, had basically needed to replenish people that were retiring. And then the other high point, I would say, is trying to move the agency forward into some technological areas. We were a little bit out of activities in terms of IT, and I think we've improved those. And then probably the third one would be in the international arena, where we've tried to increase our capabilities.
And what challenges do you see coming up? Ask you about them in three general areas, try and bound the question a little bit. The first would be applications for new reactors. The second would be license renewals. And then the third would be reactor design certification. And you should know this group has a particular interest in the challenges and opportunities faced by developers of small reactors.
Well, Well, I think the in terms of some of the challenges, I think wrestling with waste confidence will have to be number one on the near-term challenge. And that's an area that's going to be difficult because one of the findings that has been in the waste confidence arena is stating the date that a repository will open. And so there's some discussions on how they might eliminate the need for that date. So I think the initial one challenge will be waste confidence. On the small reactor area, you know, that's an area that's a little bit frustrating for us because I believe that small reactors have a needed role for the United States and certainly for other countries. Being a fee-recovered agency, we need a customer that will pay the bills unless Congress provides the money. So we're sort of in a catch-22. No utility or municipality would want to basically buy a small reactor until it's certified. We can't really do a certification unless we have the funds to pursue that. On the COL side, I think that there we just need to keep focused on the schedule and make sure that we respond in a timely manner. And certainly the first one out of the chute is likely to be Vogtle. And I think the important thing there is that it needs to stay on schedule and on budget.
Mr. Klein, one of the comments that the chairman has made on a number of occasions was that some applications were not as complete as what the commission would like to see. Is there a place where applicants can go and see exactly what they need to have to satisfy the commission's desires for completeness?
You know, I think what I usually tell people are three things that will occur to make applications more complete, and that's communication, communication, and communication. We need to articulate what we require, and then as we communicate those back to the applicants, future applicants need to look at those. And so if we looked at the COL applications, they got better and better as we reviewed more of them and communicated back what was missing. So I think over time, the COL process will get much better as not only the applicants understand better what's needed, but the NRC is better able to articulate what we want. So I think on the COL side, that will improve it itself. On the design cert side, that one is which we were surprised that some of the applications were not as complete, given the fact that we had given a lot of feedback as to what we wanted. So I think the design certification will work its way through because that one is a little more unique. On the COL, you know, once we get the patterns down, those were going to be more consistent, and I think we'll get more efficient both from the licensees and from the regulatory review.
Well, one of the reasons that I asked that question is I was at a meeting where a representative of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was in front, and someone asked, well, how do we go and find all of the feedback you've given? Do you have a database? Do you have some sort of a place where it's all in one place? And the response was sort of, well, you just have to go back and look at all the feedback we've given to the other applicants. And, of course, as like you said, as a fee-for-service agency, some of the people in the room seemed kind of frustrated because they said, well, we have to pay every time we talk to you guys.
Yeah, well, it seems like, you know, that's a good suggestion, and there's really no reason that we couldn't provide a better process for feedback. I'll follow up with that one to see if there's a way we can do it better because I do know that when we provide feedback, it's in a public forum. I don't know how people would access that, but I'll take that as an action item and see if we can't make it better.
Mr. Klein, this is John Wheeler. I had an opportunity this past Thursday to speak at two different high schools about careers in nuclear power and really broader in the nuclear science and technology fields. And inevitably, when I get into those situations, I spend a lot of time speaking about the technology and dispelling myths about the technology. With that in mind, and with the difficulty that we're having related to misunderstanding of the impact of tritium in these small tritium leaks that have occurred at some plants, what do you think the commission's role is on helping to educate the public about nuclear science and technology, with the thought that an educated public is going to be able to make better decisions related to nuclear science?
Well, John, you hit on one of my pet peeves is, as a regulator, we cannot be a promoter nor an opponent of nuclear energy. But I've been a very strong advocate that we can be an educator. And I think we really need to work much harder than we have been on trying to educate people on what to be concerned about and what not to be concerned about on nuclear power. And I think tritium is a classic case, particularly when you give a measurement of picocuries per liter. Most people don't know what a picocurie is. They probably understand what a liter is, but we speak in terms that is hard for people to understand. And so I would like for us to have a website that really answers people's legitimate questions, and we do it in a much better way. One of the challenges that I oftentimes say is, and since I'm an engineer, I can say this with some experience, is that if you ask an engineer what time it is, they'll tell you how to make a watch. And we need to get much better at communicating short, accurate answers to the public and answer their questions without telling them how to make a watch. And so I think our website has gotten much better, but it has a long way to go where people really do need a short, easy, quick answer to their concerns. And then if they want to go for more information, they can click down for more detail. But we really need to work a lot better in educating the public on nuclear issues.
I'll make a comment on that, too. You commented earlier about one of the big wins for the NRC was the hiring of a large amount of new staff to replace the retiring, just like the rest of the industry is suffering from the boomer retirement. What about the education of the NRC staff? I've worked with some great reviewers there, and I've worked with people who clearly don't understand their own technology. Are you guys working internally to improve the knowledge? Because I know you're having to hire people that have a limited knowledge of nuclear power.
Yeah, we're working very hard on what we call a knowledge management system. And fortunately, a lot of our very good retirees are willing to come back and work part-time to help train this new set of workers. At the end of 2009, we had about 50% of our employees have been at the NRC 6 years or less. That's a tremendous change for any agency, particularly a technical regulator. And so we're working very hard to train our workers. And I think we've got a good system in place. You know, it obviously any program has weaknesses, but we're working very diligently to train our cadre of new workers. And we have a very formal management knowledge management program, and we have a lot of training that we send our people to.
Mr. Klein, I've got a question about the idea of being a neutral regulator. It appears to me that the NRC's got some clear direction in its charter to protect the environment, yet the Environmental Protection Agency has issued an endangerment finding on CO2. And we all know that nuclear plants don't produce CO2. But if we shut down a nuclear plant or discourage the use of nuclear, we actually add CO2 to the environment. Isn't there a problem there with the neutrality to nuclear technology?
Well, there is to a certain extent, but I think that's where the Department of Energy needs to step up to the table and correct information and provide information. When the Atomic Energy Commission was split, the intent was to separate the promoter from the regulator. And so while I agree that it does put the NRC in a little bit of a difficulty, but again, I think what we need to do as a regulator is provide factual information and let agencies like DOE be the promoter?
This is Dan Yerman. I'd like to ask, come back to your comment about waste confidence and also this issue of communicating science to the public. The debate about Yucca Mountain has been largely framed in political terms, and I hear some frustration from you that has taken place. It would seem, based on the comments you've given this group this evening, that framing it in terms of the science as a base decision would be a better fit with the NRC's mission. That sounds like a hot button for you. I wonder if you'd share some of your thoughts with us about that.
Well, Dan, the thing that's frustrating for me is that, you know, the NRC did not receive the application until, you know, the spring of 08, and we were gearing up to do our technical analysis. I think what a lot of people have seemed to forget is that, you know, our job as a regulator is to make that technical evaluation of the Yucca Mountain application. We had made no decision whether it was acceptable or unacceptable, but we were going down the path to make that determination. And it really is unfortunate on the human side, where we had people who had spent literally decades getting ready to perform this technical analysis, and then all of a sudden we're not able to do that. As I had stated in my RIC speech, clearly the president has the opportunity and the right to change policy decision, but they really should do it on factual grounds, and I think we're going to see a lot of litigation coming in for the way that that decision was handled. Again, as a regulator, I would have preferred that we would have had an opportunity to do our job and make that technical assessment. Whether or not it's ever opened up is a policy call, and that is a fair one for Congress to make. But I would have liked to have seen us have the opportunity to evaluate that application. I think we would have learned a lot from it. That doesn't mean that it would have necessarily opened, but it would have, I think, let us understand how to go about making a geological decision, because even if we recycle, we will need a permanent geological disposal at some point in time.
Well, this sounds like the agenda that is going to be handed to the Blue Ribbon Commission when it meets on the 25th and 26th of this month, which is this coming week. How do you see that group weighing in on this issue?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what their charge is, whether Yucca Mountain is on the table or off the table. So I think, again, the commission has some very capable people on it that I think will want to understand what their charge is, and it will be fascinating to see how that's articulated.
Have you been asked by the commission to provide any input to them?
No.
Mr. Klein, what do you see as the time frame when we would need to have to store material someplace other than on the surface, particularly if we're recycling? Is there anything upcoming that causes it to be unsafe where it is?
No, I think one of the challenges that we have on storage is articulating that we know how to do it. You know, we have procedures that it can be done safely. I do personally favor central interim storage. I was on the MRS Review Commission in the late 80s. And our commission that looked at that study for over 18 months recommended central interim storage so that utilities can do what they do, and that is generate electricity in a safe, reliable manner and let some other organization deal with the storage of the spent fuel. That recommendation obviously was not followed, but I, again, as a regulator, we can't propose that. That, again, should be done by DOE. But I think the Blue Ribbon Commission will take a look probably at whether central interim storage is a good idea. And I think that will be one of the things that they can look at. Clearly, at reactors, storage is safe. Central storage is safe. It's just a matter of which one is the better of the two.
I had a question. And I blog at Yes Vermont Yankee, and you can tell perhaps by the title of my blog that I agree with Tip O'Neill that all politics is local. And I guess I want to ask about what I call the Mason-Dixon line. Well, it isn't really quite at the Mason-Dixon line, but it does seem that there's some sort of anti-thing going on in the North and pro-thing going on in the South, and I wondered how that affects what happens at the NRC or how the NRC affects that, or maybe you don't agree with my assessment here.
Well, I think the for whatever reason, it's not clear why, but I think in general, the Southeast seems to be more supportive of nuclear than the Northeast. If I lived in the Northeast in the winter, I think I would certainly want safe, secure, clean, reliable electricity for those winters, because loss of life could occur when that is not present. So it's not clear to me why that occurs. You know, I'm not a, you know, one that is an expert in sociology, but I think the plants that have had some difficulties in communicating their safe operation have been in the Northeast. And part of that could be that the utilities that are doing this are not being as effective in communicating as they need to be. So it's a complicated area, but if you look, we have 104 nuclear plants running nationwide. The NRC is a regulatory body that is charged with protecting people and the environment, so there's a check and balance system around. And I think the communities just have to hopefully make educated decisions on where they get that electricity. There's a lot of people who would like to hope on future alternatives that may or may not be available. But if you're a utility, you have to do on what's available now and make decisions now. And there's a lot of people who are very supportive of solar and wind, of which we certainly need, but that's not a baseload of electrical generation. And so, you know, we really need to educate, I think, a lot of people on what baseload electricity is. And when you come to that, wind and solar typically just are not part of that energy mix for base load.
Could I ask also if you think there's anything that is being done in the southern tier that is kind of a lesson learned from for the northern tier about communication? Because you said that, you know, the big issue is communicating in the north, and I certainly am trying my best to communicate up here in Vermont, which is about as far north as you can go before you hit the Canadian border. At least right here, you go Maine, you can go further north. But anyway, if you can think about some kind of lesson learned in communication, maybe you could tell us a little about it.
Well, I think part of that would be, you know, somehow getting the people at the plant to be more proactive in telling people what they do and how they do it. And again, I don't know if that is occurring there, but it always amazes me that people oftentimes make accusations that the plant workers are not doing their best in running the plant safely. Well, most of the workers live near the plants and their families live there. And so I think for a credible source, the workers really have to stand up and defend themselves as part of that package of explaining people what they do. In general, the support around nuclear plants is quite high. The further away you get from the plants where they don't get the benefit directly, emotions seem to play a stronger role. But I think there needs to be a very proactive educational discussion of electricity and what the real options are, not what hopes of electrical generation are, but what the real options are for baseload generation. And I think you have to build that foundation and knowledge before there's a problem, because if you wait until there's a problem, then you've really have an uphill battle.
I agree with you completely on that. You really have to start early.
Mr. Klein, I have a question for you. One of the other regulators in the federal government, Mr. John Wellinghoff, has on a number of occasions said that there's no such need as baseload anymore. He says it's an obsolete concept. He's the chairman of the Federal Electricity Regulatory Commission.
He must have a database that's much different than mine. I think we will have a need for baseload electrical generation for a long, long time. and the facts are the facts. I mean, you just, there's no alternative in the near term for anything other than base load, because for some reason people want electricity at night. They like to keep lights available and their homes heated if they have electric heat. And so I think base load electrical generation, from everything that I've studied and I've spent my career in the energy business since the mid-70s, and I don't know how we could have an electrical generation system without base load. The whole world has base load systems. It's not just the U.S.
Well, I guess the difference is that you're an engineer and Mr. Wellinghoff is a lawyer.
That may explain part of it.
Mr. Klein, I'd like to ask you on this question of baseload generation and public education. One of the key issues I know the NRC has worked on is reactor life extension. And in particular, the NRC completed the relicensing for 20 years of the Oyster Creek plant, one of the oldest in the nation, and is currently engaged in relicensing activities associated with Indian Point and Vermont Yankee. Without getting too specific about those plants, since I know that's an active an area where the commission is active, I wonder if you could address this issue of how long can the current fleet really last, and at what point do we really have to be replacing reactors? What's the real time horizon for a nuclear reactor built today?
You know, that's a great question, and the short answer is we know we can extend the lives for another 20 years. We have a very good knowledge and understanding of that. We've done at least 59 of those, of the 104 that are operational. So we have a very good understanding. They go through a very rigorous review. We look at materials aging and a lot of issues. So we are very confident of how we go about that for 60 years. We're starting a program to see if there's life beyond 16. That doesn't mean anyone's specific age. But we're seeing if we can run these plants for maybe up to 80 years. And one of the things I think is important for people to realize that most of the plant is replaced during its operational time. If pumps wear out, they're replaced. If valves wear out, they're changed. Instrumentation is modified and upgraded and modernized. So just because the plant is 40 or 60 years old doesn't mean that all the components are that way. It's sort of like you don't throw your car away if you have a flat tire. And so we will start a program with the Department of Energy to understand the technical issues that we need to address to see if we can license these from 60 to 80. At some point in time, the maintenance will possibly be so much that it's better to start over and build a new plant. But the American people have benefited greatly by the life extensions because electricity is generated in a safe, reliable manner, and the public does not have to pay for a huge capital investment. I think one of the challenges we have in the nuclear field, the initial capital costs of these plants are quite high, but you're really buying these plants for your grandchildren and great-grandchildren because they will be in operation for a long time, and that's a tough concept for a lot of people to understand when we're looking at a plant that might run, you know, even up to 100 years if they're properly maintained, and that's a long term operation.
There's a local coal plant around here in New Hampshire. It went online in 68, and it's currently completing a $487 million upgrade. So that apparently they expect that coal plant to be online for quite a bit of time in the future, though it's over 40 years old right now. I'm just commenting
I'm sure
that other plants, the nuclear, it doesn't seem to be such an issue that, oh, yeah, you know, you wear out this part, you replace it, and everybody seems to just sort of shrug.
Yeah, I think it's an area that if people really think about it and they think about, you know, either their houses getting renovated and remodeled or their cars being upgraded and modernized, you know, these plants really can operate safely for extended periods of time. And And for us, for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, we have a rigorous inspection program as well as the rigorous inspection that the operators themselves have. So again, there's a check and balance to make sure that the safety is not compromised just because the plant is getting older.
Sir, how do you answer the people who say, well, these plants were, quote, designed to only last 40 years?
You know, that, to my understanding, that is not the case at all. The they did an economic life of what the plants at the time they thought would be reasonable. And so the Atomic Energy Act, when the nuclear industry was just starting, picked 40 years as the value that they were very confident that the plants could run at least 40 years. That didn't mean that at year 41 the plant crumbles and goes into sand. It was just when the Atomic Energy Act was created, 40 years was a value they felt comfortable with, and that's all that means. It does not mean that people thought that at the end of 40 they would just collapse.
Yeah, I believe that 40 was picked because that was the license period for hydroelectric dams, which was the only federally licensed electric supply at the time. And they just picked that and said, oh, we know that they can last 40 years. These will probably last at least 40 years as well.
Yeah, so it was more of a convenient number rather than a scientific number.
Mr. Klein, what do you think of this new threat to nuclear plants from folks who claim to be environmentalists who are using the once-through cooling argument way to get plants to shut down?
For some reason, you broke up on the question, and I couldn't hear that. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, I'm just curious to get your thoughts on the group of folks who are out there advocating for to force large power plants to install cooling towers in lieu of once-through cooling, and using some of the EPA regulations as a basis for that argument. I'm just interested in hearing your thoughts on whether or not that will gain traction, and if it does, what threat would it pose to our electric supply system nationwide?
Well, I think from our standpoint as a regulator, we just want to make sure that sufficient cooling capability is available so the plants can operate in a safe manner. So as a regulator, we don't get involved in that. However, if you look at what I've been hearing from Exelon with Oyster Creek, if a company is required to spend more money than they think is appropriate for the value of the plant, then they will have little choice but to shut the plant down. And if that occurs, then that amount of baseload generation will be removed, and you'll have to provide that baseload with some other alternative, and that would either be coal or natural gas.
A question for you on back to the licensing of new reactors. The head of the Nuclear Energy Institute gave a speech last week in which he said he thought the nuclear renaissance was slowing down. He said that he thinks that electricity demand, because of the current economic conditions, might stretch out the new build schedule. I wonder if the NRC is seeing that in terms of the way applicants are either working with the agency on their applications or their schedule for submitting new ones.
I can tell you from my standpoint as a regulator, the renaissance is still alive and well. We have a full plate of things we're working on, including the uranium mining, the enrichment, the fabrication, as well as the new plants. We have had about 5 applications ask us to do a deferral. We have not had anyone who has actually withdrawn a COL. I do think with the drop in demand for electricity because of the economic situation we're in, that some utilities are changing their forecast for when they have to have the plant up in operation. As a regulator, I don't mind that because I would rather us as a nation and as a regulatory agency build 2 to 3 or 4 plants very well before we start 8 at the same time. So from my standpoint, the little bit of slowing down that we're seeing because of a drop in demand will, I think, benefit us to do a smaller number of plants better, will let us focus on those and get the supply chain reestablished as the economy does a rebound.
Yeah, I believe it's a little bit short-sighted for some of the folks to slow down too much, because right now the price of the commodities that was skyrocketing when everybody was looking at the increasing demand, the commodities have dropped in price, so it might be a good time to continue moving forward with due diligence and buy stuff while it's going is easier.
I know some utilities are, in fact, trying to lock in some of their commodity prices, and it doesn't take many trips to China and or India and to see the huge economic demand that's occurring in those countries. And once the economies of the world pick back up, it's very likely the price of natural gas will go up, in addition if there is a tax on carbon. All of those factors will come into play that will probably need to have an increased look at nuclear generation capacity among the options that are available.
One other question. You mentioned China and India, but and at the very beginning you talked about your efforts in the international arena as one of the things that you're proud about. It seems like there's an awful lot of small countries who have never before had a regulatory environment for nuclear are interested in developing one. Can you tell us a little bit about what kinds of things have happened in, say, Jordan and the United Arab Emirates and Egypt and a few other countries that have mentioned that they are interested in new nuclear plants?
Well, interestingly enough, I just came back last Thursday from the United Arab Emirates. And I think this is an interesting case because they obviously have a lot of oil and gas, but they're looking for the future. You know, they're looking at selling that oil and gas on the world market. And so they want to build energy alternatives for that base load generation. I think the United Arab Emirates has really done it right. They've hired some very good people to write their regulatory requirements. Our former executive director of operation, Bill Travers, is working, as well as other people from around the world, to help them write a regulatory framework. They pass laws, they're hiring people, they're training them. So they've really done it right. I think countries like Jordan are also getting interested in that, as well as Egypt. And so I think it's very important for those countries to realize that you don't make a decision to go nuclear and the next year have a plant that's operating. It's going to be a very long process. United Arab Emirates understands that. They're doing it very thoughtful, very logically, and they have selected the Koreans to supply that technology, which is based on the combustion engineering system 80+. But the Koreans, South Korea, has done a very good job of building reactors and operating them. And so I think that's a positive example of how to move forward for a country that has never had commercial nuclear plants, but they're doing it in a very thoughtful manner. And we're seeing a lot of countries. There are about 60 countries that have expressed an interest in having nuclear plants that have never had them before. And there are probably about 10 of them that are very serious and moving forward.
That's pretty exciting news. I just like the idea of countries that are even oil and gas producers recognizing that nuclear is perhaps a better way to generate electricity internally rather than burning some of their precious commodities.
Yeah, and I think a country like United Arab Emirates, that obviously has a huge supply of oil and gas, is looking for the future, and they see nuclear as a safe, reliable source for their citizens.
I have a question for you, Dr. Klein, about lessons learned. The Chinese are building a number of new reactors. They've placed orders for 4 Westinghouse reactors, 2 from Areva and 2 also from the Russians. Is there any lessons learned work going on between the NRC and your counterparts in China in terms of the experience that they're gaining building these plants, bringing them back to the U.S.?
Absolutely. In fact, we have a lot of change of people that go over and are watching the construction so we can learn lessons. So it lets us train some of our construction inspectors to watch what they're doing. In addition, Lee Ganji, the head of their regulatory activity, and I have talked many times, and we are helping train their regulators and help them where we can. They will, again, modify and create their own regulatory structure, but we're sharing all of our information with China because it's in our interest as well as theirs to do it right. But we are learning a lot of lessons on construction. We're learning about the supply chain, techniques that work, techniques that don't work. I visited the Shaw facility in Louisiana that's doing the modular design, and so they're also learning how to make it better. So when the Vogtle plant utilizes some of that same techniques, that they will take those lessons learned, and it'll benefit us in the U.S.
Does the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have permanent staff stationed in China for that purpose?
We rotate them through, and so we've had several people that have spent several months. We also have had people in Finland. We also have people in Flamanville in France. And what we want to do as far as the regulatory aspects go, when we start building in the U.S., we want to have a trained cadre of people that will be ready to do the construction and inspection, be ready to roll, so that the NRC will not be the stumbling block.
You talked about the supply chain earlier in terms of getting it ramped up to support new reactor construction. Most people listening to this know what NQA-1 is and how it relates to the quality of components supplied to a nuclear reactor. The question is, what is the NRC doing with suppliers of components to get them ready to participate in the supply chain?
You know, we do a lot of vendor inspections. We will help companies understand what our requirements are. We go through an inspection program. We work with other countries. And when we first built the reactors in the U.S. in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we were almost entirely a domestic supply chain. Now we are in a global market. And so there are a lot of companies that now see the demand coming back in the U.S. that previously had the N stamp, the nuclear quality, that want to get back into business. And so I think we'll see a lot of those manufacturing companies start back up. It's unlikely that that will result in those very big forging components. I think Japan Steelworks and South Korea and also in France will do those big, heavy forging. But a lot of companies are seeing the demand go up and are restarting the nuclear business that has been shut down for many years.
Well, the question I have, I guess, especially for some of the smaller suppliers, does the NRC have, or have you thought of having, a one-stop shop for a vendor who, say, makes machine parts or pumps or valves or seals or circuit boards or whatever, can come in and learn about this? We've gotten some feedback that they're not sure how to approach the agency, who they call first and so forth. Do you have a single point of contact for that kind of information?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that we view our role as helping people learn about what we do. And so certainly if they call, through the EDO's office, the Executive Director of Operation, we should be able to get them to the right people and let them know what documents to look for. Some of the certification is done by ASME, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, on the N stamp. So some of the activities are controlled by other technical bodies that use our guidelines. But certainly we have people who can help small companies get back into business.
Well, the reason I'm raising this is that some firms who work as contractors for the Department of Energy have people who are employed to do outreach to the vendor community to give them guidance, to provide them with information, and to, like, for instance, you said, get them in touch with the right people. Is there maybe a cross-cutting responsibility both inside and outside the government trying to organize this information better? You mentioned that ASME has a role. Your agency has a role. Perhaps industry trade associations are also in the mix. If I was a small vendor, I think I might, have a question. Okay, who do I call first? So that's why I was raising this issue, because I think it can be confusing. And I'm just wondering if the agency sees it within its mission to try and do outreach in this area, as well as getting the public to understand the technology better.
You know, that's a great question, and the answer is I wish we could. But Congress passed this requirement that we have to recover 90% of our fees from those we regulate. And so, unfortunately, that limits a lot of our outreach activities. I think what we try to do is be responsive as people come in and want information. But with our current budget, I would love to have that flexibility, to have that outreach. But again, I think that initial responsibility would really have to be driven by another agency like DOE or Commerce or someone like that. It's just, you know, I wish we could do that as a regulator, but because of our fee structure and how we have to recover funds, we just don't have the funds to have that kind of a proactive business development aspect.
Dr. Klein,
let's flip the coin on the other side. I know the NRC takes very seriously the risk of counterfeit parts showing up in the supply chain. What is the agency doing in that area these days?
Well, we're very active in our vendor inspection program. We have an international exchange. If anyone finds the counterfeit parts, we share that with all the regulators. And so we try to stay on top of that to prevent any kind of counterfeiting. That's where, again, the utilities have to also play a significant role to make sure they're buying from reliable vendors. But we do share that information worldwide among all regulators. And when we find counterfeit parts, we publish that right away.
Dr. Klein, are there any other federal regulators that have the same sort of fee structures as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? I'm thinking of the Federal Aviation Administration or the Food and Drug Administration or others that have similar public safety roles as you do.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I do know the FAA certainly charges the airlines. I know that FERC charges as well. And my guess is during budget times that our 535 advisors have looked at ways to minimize taxpayer expense and have shifted some of those costs to the actual users, like in our case, to the utilities and fuel fabricators and the mining. So I'm sure they're out there. I'm just not sure how many there are and how their structures are.
And you also mentioned several times mining. For a while, the U.S. did not do much uranium mining at all. Have you seen a change in that in the last several years?
We have seen a huge increase in the uranium recovery. There's a lot of what's called ISR, in situ recovery, where it's solution mining. And we were looking at having about 25 applications for people going out and recovering uranium. If yellowcake is $100 a pound, you have a lot more people looking at it than if it's $30 a pound.
Or under $10 a pound.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's when the U.S. stopped mining uranium. It was we went through a period where for about 20 years it was hovering around $10 a pound and just wasn't worth the effort.
Remember, too, for the last 10 years, we've gotten half of our uranium from downblended weapon stockpiles.
Yeah, about 50% of the nuclear electrical generation is from Russian former weapons usable material.
Now, so that's been that has lessened the demand on the market for mining of additional uranium. Eventually, that stockpile of material will be all burnt up and turned into electricity, and then the demand will continue to increase.
Yeah, with the number of new nuclear plants being built worldwide, if you look at just China has about 21 plants under construction. That's going to result in an increased demand for fuel, and I think that's what's driven the price up, and therefore a lot of companies have expressed interest in uranium recovery.
Okay, our silences are getting a little bit longer. How about if each one of us asks one more question, and then we'll let Dr. Klein enjoy the rest of his Sunday evening.
Yeah, just a follow-up question on your comment about doing a better job of communicating facts with the public. One of the things that I've noticed recently is that some of the and I want to talk about any details about Vermont Yankee, but recently some of the Vermont Yankee employees have become more active in writing letters to their newspapers, and are getting positive attention from the local media. And I believe that that is having a positive effect. Do you have any advice for others around the country who are in the nuclear industry and in a whole variety of different roles and in their ways that they can reach out and assist all of us in having a more informed public?
Well, I think what you all do really adds a lot of value for that educational aspect in itself. So keep up what you're doing. In addition, higher education has to be, I think, more proactive in educating people on energy. Government has a role to play, and certainly the industry. I think one of the more credible sources of factual information about a nuclear plant comes from the plant workers. You know, they're in those plants every day, and they can speak with authority on what they do to generate electricity in a safe, reliable manner. And so I would encourage certainly all the utilities to encourage their people to go out and be more proactive. Because if they don't, and only one side keeps hitting the either the electronic or the print media, then after a while people will start thinking that that's the only answer. So it's very important for factual, credible information to be out for the public that have legitimate questions.
And I want to follow up on that one. One of the things that's a little bit frustrating to me is after September 11th, 2001, the access to nuclear plants for tours or for even the visitor centers became severely restricted. And one of, to me, one of the most successful ways to convince people that nuclear plants are clean and safe is to actually have them come and look at a plant and see what it really is like. Can you talk a little bit about some of the restrictions and if there's going to be any change to those anytime in the future?
Well, one of the things that I've been on a soapbox is I would really like to see these new plants be designed with tours built in. When I go to Japan and you go through a plant, you can go through and you can look down on a control room, you can look in a turbine generator area, you can see the key parts of the plant that you need to understand how it works without disrupting the work that's needed to be done. So for these new plants in the U.S. that are being built, I think it is extremely important that we design tours into these plants. What I've told the utilities is that if you just think about the next 100 years that this plant might be operating, it's very likely that somewhere in the world there will be a problem of some kind. And if we don't get the public back into those plants and make them less mysterious, where the public can really see what's going on, it will be very difficult to maintain public confidence. And so it's very important that we get tours back into these plants and we get visitor centers back up in operation.
Well, here's my last question, Dr. Klein. You talked about the cost recovery requirement from Congress. There are new reactor designs coming in, especially in the small reactor area. And in a few years, we may see the first wave of so-called Gen 4 reactors. The NRC will have to figure out a way to cover the costs. Primarily, the agency now is a light water reactor agency. If Congress were to ask you, hypothetically speaking, for a legislative package that would change the way the NRC operates in order to accommodate covering the costs of dealing with these new reactor designs, what would be in it?
I think the NRC should have additional funds that could look at small reactors and for non-light water reactors as well as recycling technologies, because we need to build up a database of technical experts that will let us understand what regulatory requirements are needed if we have a Gen 4 non-light water reactor, if we have a recycling plant, and if we have a small reactor. So I would very much be in favor of additional revenue streams from basically the taxpayer rather than the ratepayer to provide us the opportunity to expand our technical expertise so we can be ready for the next generation of technology.
I guess my last question is rather just shows I don't really understand some things. I didn't really realize that the NRC was also involved in regulating mining. Isn't that rather far afield? I mean, I don't think of the Federal Aviation Administration as regulating the production of jet fuel at refineries, or I don't know. It's just a generic question.
If it's radiation, we're involved in it in some way or another. And so, even though we don't look at the mine safety, but for the characteristics of uranium recovery, we oftentimes license those facilities in conjunction with the requirements that EPA may establish for groundwater requirements.
Okay, now my last question. I'm going to go back to communication. One of the things that I notice over my years of working with you guys is that public forums are generally an opportunity for those who don't understand nuclear power or are generally against it. I'm talking about the intervener process, I guess. When the NRC does public forums in that regard, the only people that really are allowed a chance to get up and speak in public seem to be the ones that have issues with the possibility of a plant being built in their area. Is there a way for those of us that think nuclear is a good thing and that we'd like to see it in our areas to also get a voice at those hearings and at those open forums?
Absolutely. And in fact, we basically, when we do our reactor oversight briefings of the plant each year, these are public meetings where for both pro and con people can speak. And same thing for hearings. When we had the hearings at Vogtle, for example, on Units 3 and 4, there were a lot of local community groups and individuals that came in support of that plant. A lot of the people who spoke against it were not from the local area, which did not set well with some of the local people. But in all of our hearings, we do not discriminate whether you're for or against an issue in order to speak.
Good to know. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Klein, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with a bunch of gray-haired old bloggers who actually probably fall pretty much into the same age range as some of the folks that you're replacing at the NRC. And please, folks, don't.
I was going to say my colorist would object to that comment, Rod.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. That's the way I am sometimes. I put my foot in my mouth, but we really appreciate your time and your service. I don't know about if I'm speaking for everybody else, but I will miss you as a member of the NRC. I hope that the three new commissioners will help keep the agency going forward, and I hope that as the commission moves forward, it continues to be one of the best places to work in the federal government.
Well, thanks for those comments. I think we do have three very capable commissioners coming on board that will add value, and I'd like to thank you all for what you do to help educate the public. As an academic at heart, we all have to work harder at educating people on facts and not just emotions.
But some of us don't mind using emotions now and again because we really do feel pretty passionate about this stuff.
Emotions are good. It's just sometimes those negative emotions get in the way.
I hope you enjoyed that. We believe that communicating about nuclear energy, nuclear technology is vitally important. It's great to see someone as distinguished as Dr. Klein come and give us the respect of listening to our questions, talking with you, and sharing what he knows about the technology, the politics, the licensing. For those of you who are in the nuclear industry, please take Dr. Klein's advice and be communicative. Share with people that you know. Talk to people in your local community and try to overcome the veil of ignorance that has slowed down the development of nuclear technologies. For now, bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.